Presge.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. Coming up today, we're going to get two views of Florida, one from a free market group that says that Florida is the freest state in the country, and another from an anti-poverty group that says that Florida needs to do more for working people. But first, four listener comments about yesterday's interview with Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign manager. Here's what four listeners had to say.
I was just listening to the show today, and if anybody would open up a dictionary and look at the definition of socialism, it's where a group of people, citizens of a country or a state, collectively pay in to a tax system which provides infrastructure, provides military, provides national parks, public schools, the police department, public transportation, roads, highways, and the list goes on. Now, the right repeats this mantra over and over and over. They repeat this line of socialism being so evil. And if you go back to the 1850s and 60s, the most socialistic liberal politicians that we ever had came out of the Republican Party from the Whig Party. Within Lincoln's party, you had guys like Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner that would make Bernie Sanders and Andrew Gillum today look like Herbert Hoover.
Thank you for the interview with the 2016 campaign manager for Bernie Sanders. I agree with the last three words in his book. Run, Bernie, run. I think Bernie Sanders is the perfect candidate to take on Donald Trump in 2020. Think about it. Clash of the Titans. Trump versus Sanders. Loser leaves town.
Tracy in St. Pete. Socialism to me is not a bad word. I always saw socialism as taking care of the citizens in your country, making sure that everyone has food to eat and, you know, a place to live, and just taking care of the people in your country. I don't understand why people think it's such a bad thing. We do that. We have Medicare. We take care of the elderly people. We take care of children. So I just think Republicans just don't care about human life. They like to say they do, but I really don't think they care that much about what happens to people.
This is about the guy who was the campaign manager for Bernie, and he was progressive. So anyway, I wanted to say it was music to my ears to hear the progressive voice. Progressive Democrats and working class Americans of whatever persuasion can really get this lovely country on the right track to peace and prosperity for all. It's my prayer, and I heard it there on your radio station. I'm just so sorry about the great divisions from both sides. It's the tribalism of us versus them, when anything that we do cannot be criticized, and anything that they do cannot be agreed upon, or, you know, found any virtue in it all. And he, your commentator, made the beautiful point that we are to build on what went before and make it even better. I can't stand the hatred that's gone on.
Well, there you have some listener comments that came after yesterday's program. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And as always, you can always email your comments into the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. Well, first up today, the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank that's heavily funded by the billionaire Koch brothers, has just issued a report saying that Florida is the freest state in America. Earlier this week, I spoke with the co-author of the report, William Ruger, a research fellow in foreign policy studies at Cato Institute, to find out why Cato says Florida is the freest state in the U.S. William Ruger, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay, so you came out with a report. You and your co-author, Jason Sorens, came out with a report saying from the Cato Institute that your analysis finds Florida's the freest state in America. That's a pretty big deal. What makes Florida so free in your mind?
Well, Freedom in the 50 States is a very comprehensive study and ranking of freedom across the country. It looks at fiscal policies, regulatory policies, personal freedom, about 230 policies in total, and that's everything from taxation to debt, eminent domain laws to occupational licensing, alcohol policy to educational choice. So there's a lot of things that go into that. But what's great about Florida in terms of its respect for the freedom of its citizens is that it does well across the board. It's not merely a case in which it does well in economic freedom, but it's fairly paternalistic about people's personal lives, or vice versa. And that's kind of the stereotype of the red state or blue state, is that they're good on one margin, not so good in the others. Florida's great across the board.
Now, are you measuring, is this individual freedom or is this freedom for businesses?
It's individual freedom. And so, again, with that personal freedom aspect that looks at things like gambling laws or gun laws or educational parental choice laws, alcohol policy, right? So it's not merely what's good for business. I mean, one of the problems with some of those pro-business indices is that they aren't focused on freedom. They're focused on what's good for business. And we're concerned about how government policy affects individuals and their lives and their ability to kind of choose their life as they see fit. And so it's very much not a business index.
As I look at this, I don't see any category for freedom of speech. Was that an oversight? If you're talking about individual freedom.
Yeah, so there actually is some things. So, for example, in some states, they mandate free speech on people's private property. So, for example, they insist that a shopping mall has to have to let people come on their property and speak. That's one thing we measure on that free speech category. But fortunately, one of the things about free speech is that it is strongly protected in the United States, especially because of the First Amendment and the case law around that. And so there actually isn't very much variation across the states when it comes for restrictions like that. When we look at policies, we're trying to look at and to see where there are differences. Because, again, if every state is respecting certain freedoms, then there's no ability to really say how they're different.
Okay, so if somebody exerts their free speech rights on private property, that, in your mind, is a bad thing. For instance, let's just say, NFL players exerting free speech rights at the stadium just before the game, that's a bad thing. That, you would say, that's a negative thing for freedom.
Well, we're not making a judgment about how people use speech or if they engage in protest. We're looking at, rather, at what laws restrict people's ability to speak freely where they have a right to free speech. So, for example, we would say that if someone came into your bedroom and said, hey, I want to protest, your views on X, Y, and Z, that would be a violation of your right to property. But if the government speak in the public square, then that would be a bad thing, right?
But that rarely happens. People don't go into people's bedrooms. But there are places where property owners and business owners say you can't have free speech rights on our property. For instance, you can't begin to go to organize a union in a workplace because the owner of that company says, outside people don't have rights to leaflet on our property. So you're saying that the business owner has more rights than the individual in this case, and that results in Florida getting a good freedom ranking.
Well, we're talking about 230 different variables, and none of these are the thing that is driving any particular state. If you think about the biggest portion of our index, any single variable is really only a few percentages of the overall index. So fiscal policy counts for 30%, but there's a number of different policies underneath that. If you think about regulatory policy, which is what you're talking about, that's worth 34% of the index, but that has everything from local rent control to eminent domain to, the parking lot gun mandate to lawsuit freedom. And I think our view on this issue of what you're talking about with speech is consistent with this parking lot gun view, which is a lot of people might think that hey, I should have the right to speak or bring my gun anywhere I want. And we're being consistent by saying, well, if it's on your property, that's fine. If it's on, you know, a place that you rent or if it's in the public square, but you don't have a right, for example, if your employer says, we don't want to have guns in our parking lot, we believe that, that we should, people should respect that right. Does that make sense?
No. We're talking with William Ruger. He's a research fellow in foreign policy studies at Cato Institute. He's also the vice president for research and policy at the Charles Koch Institute and a vice president for research at the Charles Koch Foundation. We're talking about a study that the Cato Institute published saying that Florida is the freest of all 50 states. Let me say why I say no. If you bring a gun on private property and you're allowed to do it and you're, let's say, an angry employee, or maybe you're a guy that wants to shoot up a video game tournament, you're allowed to bring it on private property. Well, what about the freedom of those people who don't want to get shot? I mean, their freedom is impinged by people who legally buy guns and then go crazy, whether it's an airport, it's Parkland School, it's a church, it's a mall, as we saw in Jacksonville over the weekend. Where is the freedom of those people who don't want to get shot? Where is that calculated in your study?
Well, actually, we're in agreement. We don't believe that people should be allowed to bring their guns onto private property if the property owner disagrees with that. So we code as a restriction on people's freedom if the government, say, makes property owners accept people having guns in their parking lots. So I think we're in agreement there. And again, I mean, in speaking about Florida, you know, they're doing well across the board, particularly when it comes even in the personal freedom area. You know, think about some of the civil asset forfeiture reform they've done in the criminal justice space. That's the kind of thing that I think shows the breadth of this study.
Now, you've got a lot of recommendations in your report. You say that Florida should trim spending on sanitation and sewage. How does that contribute to freedom if we trim our spending on sanitation and sewage and public parks, you say?
Well, what we were doing there is again, trying to take that macro level view and looking at how these states...
This is a weekly test of the emergency alert system. WMNF is testing equipment that can quickly warn you in the event of an emergency. This is 88.5 WMNF HD Tampa, Community Conscious Radio. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
Also would say that if a state were spending, you know, seven times more than the national average, that might be an area where we want to look and see if there could be some cost savings. Again, not saying that there shouldn't be spending on it, but questioning whether they're at the right level.
Now, we have sewage systems and water systems here in Tampa, for instance, that are collapsing all the time, and you're saying that we're spending too much on sanitation and sewage. So you want our water systems and our sewage systems to collapse more than they already do?
No. And again, you know, we're not saying that there isn't a proper role for government in a variety of different areas. What we're trying to do is to say, hey, we should look at the range of things that localities and the state are spending on. Look at that comparative perspective. And one of the things about our study that's an advantage for legislators or staffers or individuals thinking about government is that they can look across the 50 states and see how they compare. You know, when I lived in Texas, one of the things that people found remarkable down there when I told them about it is I picked certain areas and said, you know, Vermont has a bad reputation in Texas, but look at what they're doing in this area, this area, and this area. And they were surprised by that. And it's that surprise, I think, that can lead people to say, hey, maybe we ought to look at what we're doing because we're looking at it in a bubble. And I think the same in this area, right? You want to look and see what are the needs of the community for sure, but are we doing it in a way that's fiscally responsible?
Another area that you want some deregulation, you don't think that farm labor contractors should be regulated. You don't think that debt collectors, bill collectors should be regulated. How does that enhance personal freedom if farm labor contractors are not regulated more? As you know, here in Florida, there have been cases of human trafficking and farm labor slavery because people who are dishonest working in the farm labor contracting business get involved in that business and turn humans into human slaves.
Well, clearly I'm against slavery. I think anybody who cares about freedom is. What we're talking about there specifically with that recommendation, and you can see these all at www.freedominthe50states.org. You can see all the rankings and see this list of things we've been talking about and what we say about them. But what we're talking about is specifically the system of occupational licensure. This is when people need the permission of the government to go into a certain occupation. And we think that that's a real restriction on the ability of workers to find jobs, particularly people who are trying to get their leg, you know, their feet on the first rung or two of the economic ladder. So if you think about interior designers or dispensing opticians, who we also talk about here, they have to get government permission to work in those areas. I don't see how that's good for the freedom of people, particularly the freedom of people who really don't want to have to pay the costs of that permission slip, who don't want to have to pay the costs of extra classes that may have very little to do with the occupation. If you think about some of the ways in which hair braiding has been restricted, and you're seeing reforms across the country in terms of this occupational license issue, particularly when it comes to, say, hair braiders. And so there's a whole category of things in Florida that really we need to free people to be able to, you know, engage in mutual benefit with others. We're not talking about slavery.
I think a lot of people would agree with you about hair braiding, but this, the idea that you need to liberalize the regulation of farm labor contractors, given the fact that there's so much slavery in farm labor here in Florida, that seems like anti-freedom. The other place that seems like anti-freedom is when you say that we should have more unlicensed contractors. Do you want the person who's installing the electrical system in your house to be unlicensed?
Well, I think if you look at the broad range of occupational licensing, it's well beyond, you know, your surgeon. And we're not talking about people like surgeons or medical doctors, right? Because there isn't variation across the states for one. And I think people could make a reasonable argument about cases in which there were kind of really high direct, what are called externalities in economics, those might be areas where that makes sense. But what doesn't make sense is that when you have funeral attendants or bill collectors or pharmacy technicians, dispensing opticians, because there's an incentive for businesses not to hire people who are competent, not to have to get a permission slip from the government.
Well, we're talking about a new study that finds that Florida is the freest state in America, and we're talking with one of the co-authors, William Ruger. He is a research fellow in foreign policy studies at Cato Institute. He's also vice president for research and policy at the Charles Koch Institute and vice president for research at the Charles Koch Foundation. And this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. One of the ways that you rate that Florida is the freest is that when there are no mandates on businesses to provide health insurance and there's no regulation on health insurance companies, how does that add to individual freedom?
Well, a lot of the medical healthcare areas, a lot of these are federalized through because of the Obamacare decision. And so there isn't actually as much state variation in policies. I think what would be valuable is a system in which there are a lot of different options that individuals have when it comes to providers, when it comes to insurance, and different options for what insurers can cover. So if you're relatively young, you might want something more like a catastrophic coverage plan. If you want to be a little bit more risk averse and pay more upfront as opposed to paying higher copays, let's say, then that's something that you should be able to do. And so what we're saying is just that we should have a robust market in the options that are available. And look, you think about grocery stores, or you think about all kinds of other things we get in the marketplace. When you have competition, different options, more people's needs can be met. And so what we're trying to say when it comes across the board, whether it's health care or whether it's occupational freedom or whether it's, you know, personal freedom issues, more choices to be autonomous, to live the life you want without government permission is better. Now, again, there's a proper role of government in protecting people's basic fundamental rights, but that's what we think, and that's how we operationalize it in the study.
But you can buy an insurance plan that has a high deductible that barely covers anything. I think that the threat for individuals is that they buy an insurance plan, they don't read the fine print because, you know, if you look at an insurance policy, it might be 50 or 100 pages long. It's hard to read. It's hard for a layperson to understand. And they get to the point where they have a major medical problem and they get in debt because the policy is essentially worthless. So if we sell more worthless policies, that doesn't add to personal freedom, does it?
Well, I mean, I think a big part of any situation is that, you know, it's a responsibility of people to understand, you know, what they're buying and what they're getting into.
Well, let me ask you, William, in all honesty, have you read your health insurance policy?
I mean,
mine is 50.
Down a job one time because I didn't like the health insurance plan that was offered by the employer.
But my policy is at least if you look at the whole policy, it's longer than the Obamacare legislation. And I didn't read it because I'm not a lawyer. And frankly, the stuff bores me to death. So if it's up to every individual to read that 50 or 100 page insurance policy, nobody's going to read it.
Well, I mean, one of the things that happens in a free market is that there are lots of options for consumers. And if enough people and enough employers don't like policies that have that kind of situation, then generally a relatively free market will provide. And again, I think that's just maybe a basic difference that you and I share. And I think that's a reasonable debate.
But did you read your health insurance?
The hallmark of a democracy.
Did you read your health insurance policy?
Like I said, I turned down a job.
Yeah, but did you read your health insurance policy?
I mean, I read my health insurance policy every time I change a job or you get that email that says...
All 50 or 100 pages?
I can't remember what I did, you know, when I first changed jobs. What I'm saying is that more people should have more freedom, and we think that that's a good thing. Now, we can argue about, you know, this thing or that, but in general, if you look at a state like Florida, it's a lot more free than a place like New York, and people are actually acting based on that. And I think that's one thing we've lost here in the conversation is that if freedom is so bad, why is a place like New York, which is number 50 in our study, losing 14% of its population over the last two decades, and a place like Florida is increasing its population by almost 14%. If freedom's bad and people don't want to read contracts and all this other stuff, why are they rushing to Florida and leaving New York? And it's not just old people, it's also actually the youth.
Well, I can tell you, I moved from Pennsylvania to Florida. I can tell you why I moved, because of the beautiful weather and the great environment. But that's all changing as time goes on. When people move here from New York, they're going to find out it wasn't the Florida that it was 30 or 40 years ago. But let me ask you, one thing that doesn't come up in your survey is around the country, police are militarizing, and there are SWAT teams going in, arresting people for small things or even killing people for small infractions. Nowhere in this survey do I see you objecting to the militarization of police. Now, I know libertarians think that that's a problem, but why wasn't that included in your survey?
Well, we do include a lot of issues related to criminal justice. So, for example, we look at the crime-adjusted incarceration rate. And so if states are imprisoning more people than we would expect based on the crime rate, we think that's a real problem for freedom. We also look at the drug enforcement arrest rate because we think that these victimless crimes are cases where, especially when they're non-drug and they're victimless, these are things that really governments shouldn't be doing. We also look at civil asset forfeiture, which is a big issue across the country, where basically these police departments are taking people's property without the kind of due process, without a conviction that we, you know, that is should that you know, this is just a kind of abhorrent approach. When it comes to militarization of policing, that's actually is something that I've worked on in my work here at the Charles Koch Institute. We don't have specific coding here. Part of that is because of the fact that it's very difficult to look at this because it's at the local level, and there's getting the type of statistics we would need to have it in here, it would be quite difficult. It's something we should probably consider, but this is a key thing. This is something that conservatives and that want a kind of smarter approach to crime, libertarians for sure, have been paying attention to, I applaud anyone who wants to bring this up.
William, one final question. You don't like any sort of limits on campaign donations. Why don't you want limits on campaign donations?
Well, this is a tiny, tiny, tiny part of the study. It's worth 0.1%. So I think it's important to put it in that context compared to, say, you know, regulations on people's private property, eminent domain abuse, or taxation, or even things like, you know, marijuana policy. It's tiny. But I do think it's important to note that there's a speech component to engaging in the political process, and we think that that's valuable.
Yeah. Well, William Ruger, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Is there anything else that you'd like to point out about your study, which finds that Florida is the freest of all 50 states?
Well, thanks for asking. I think a big thing is just to think about those rankings. The best states are Florida, New Hampshire, Indiana, Colorado, and Nevada. The worst states in terms of freedom, New York, Hawaii, California, New Jersey, and Vermont. And what we've seen is that the better states for freedom are ones that are attracting citizens. They're having net in-migration from other states. And the states that are worse for freedom are losing people. And that holds even when you control for climate, natural amenities, things like that. So even though Florida has great weather, we're controlling for the fact that it does in our analysis, and people are still moving based on things like freedom. And so I think that people are voting with their feet, and also economic growth is better in places that are more free. And I think when you put those two things together, I think it shows that freedom does matter, even the way we define it. So even if you disagree with the way we define it as a whole, there's probably a lot of elements here that people do agree with, and people are voting for those things.
Well, William Ruger, thanks a lot. Research fellow in foreign policy studies at Cato Institute and also vice president for research and policy at the Charles Koch Institute. Thanks for coming on WMNF.
Thanks. It's, good questions, good civil discussion.
Well, that was William Ruger, co-author of the study that Cato Institute sponsored. That study found that Florida is the freest state in America. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're going to look at another study and look at how Florida treats its workers in just a moment. Just to remind you, too, that Mr. Ruger said that the worst states for freedom were New York, Vermont, Hawaii, California, and New Jersey. Well, we're joined now by Minor Sinclair. He directs Oxfam's U.S. regional office and the domestic program on decent work. Prior to his current role, Minor co-founded Oxfam International's Cuba office and worked for many years on human rights and global issues, including overseas service with the Mennonite Central Committee. Oxfam has just issued its report on the best states to work in Florida. Well, we're going to find out what Florida did in just a moment. Minor Sinclair, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Delighted to be here. Thanks, Rob.
So, Minor, tell me, how did Florida do when you were looking at how Florida treats its workers?
Well, not too sunny. Florida ranked 37th among the 50 states plus the District of Columbia. And it has a long way to go. In some respects, it's behind Arkansas. In other respects, it's behind West Virginia. And I think that's reflected, and I'll be glad to tell you how we did this study, but it's ranking in the bottom third. It shows up in a number of indicators, too, particularly in the stagnation of wages. So I'd be glad to talk about that as well.
All right, let's talk about that in a moment. But as long as we're still thinking about the Cato Institute interview I just did, Our guest from Cato Institute said that the worst states for freedom were New York, Vermont, Hawaii, California, and New Jersey. Generally speaking, how did those states treat its workers, better or worse than Florida?
Considerably better. In our study, the state of Washington came out number one. Interesting, Washington is also ranked as the best state for business. CNBC, its ranking this past year, found that Washington State ranked number one for business, and Oxfam has found that Washington State ranks number one for worker protections. So it clearly shows is that a state with good policy environment can attract businesses, can provide a very favorable business policy framework at the same time.
Yeah. What about other states that Mr. Ruger mentioned in his interview, New York, Vermont, Hawaii, California, New Jersey?
We have California at 3, Vermont at 5, and New Jersey is at 13, but we've also seen some of the policies that they're putting into place would probably indicate that its ranking would increase. Did you say Connecticut?
California, Hawaii, New Jersey, Vermont, and New York.
California number 3, Hawaii at 19, and New York at 11. So a sprinkling, but most of those within the top 15 and most of those within the top 10.
Well, our guest is Minor Sinclair with Oxfam America. He directs the Office on Domestic Program on Decent Work. And Oxfam has just come out with a study about the best states to work in for working families. Florida came in 37th. All right, so what were the criteria that you used to judge?
We grouped the criteria in three sets of policies, Rob. First one's around wages, the minimum wage as it compares to the living wage. So it's not that allows us to include the cost of living factor there. The second one's around worker protections, family leave, to are there pregnancy protections, or is there paid sick leave, are there fair scheduling practices? Are there sexual harassment protections in place? And I think most fair-minded people would say is that all of those things are goods and that they should be protected. The workers have a right to expect that in the workplace, and that government should guarantee that it happens. And the third set of policies that we analyze and incorporate into the study is the right to organize, particularly the right to whether or not a state is a right to work. That means is whether there are collective bargaining agreements that cover all of the workers in the workplace or not. The right to work, particularly for protected workers, public workers. And I do want to signal that Florida did outstanding in that category in particular. And then project labor agreements. So those are categories, and altogether we analyzed 11 policies that are blended into this index. And within that, we found that you know, frankly, you know, Florida is lacking. It does have a minimum wage slightly above the federal wage, which is positive. The first, I think, outcome of the study shows is that the federal government is missing in action. A minimum wage is at 1968 levels, which is now 50 years ago. So Florida does slightly better. But if you looked at a single parent and one child, the current minimum wage only covers about 31% of what would be considered a living wage for that family. Mm. It does not have, Florida does not enjoy protections for pregnant workers. Not prohibit pay secrecy practices in the workplace. Does not have any form of paid family leave. You know, Florida has a long way to go, and if you look at its neighboring states, or at least states in the region, I recognize, and I'm from the South as well. But you know, Florida it's in the South, you know, somewhat different, and there's a lot of reasons to believe that Florida should be a leader within the South and Mid-Atlantic region, and it's lagging behind states like Texas, and lagging behind states like Arkansas, and lagging behind states like West Virginia, all of which are also region and facing some of the same kind of challenges and opportunities that Florida has. And it's just not performing at the same level.
All right, so right now our minimum wage here, which is slightly above the national average, $8.25 an hour, that means a person working a full-time work week with no overtime would take home about $17,000 before taxes. What would a living wage be for a family, and what would a living hourly wage be for a family?
So a living wage would be around $25 an hour. And I think if most of your listeners would hear, you know, is $8.25 enough to pay for apartment? You know, single, you know, one bedroom, two bedroom, is enough to pay for daycare? You know, what happens if someone gets sick? Is that with no benefits? You know, what is your going to be your fallback in terms of medical insurance and hospital care and protection? And you'll just see is that I don't think any reasonable person is going to say is that you can get by on $8.25 an hour in Florida. Well, you know, labor protections are definitely designed to protect the those who are most vulnerable. But the other problem is that these state protections to protect all of the workers in all classes and categories. And you know, Florida has had like zero wage growth over the past 10 years. The Tampa area, Rob, your wage growth has been 0.61% over 10 years. That's not per year, that's over the last decade. So even though, as our Cato guest has indicated, Florida is booming, the workers in the state of Florida are not gaining the benefits of any of that growth.
It's not an even...
is low, great, but people are really asking themselves is that, how come this isn't happening to me? And what am I going to be able to take home?
Yeah, it's not an even growth. Some people at the very top are doing great because certainly there's a lot of million-dollar houses for sale here. But at the same time, there are a bunch of people, probably 40 or 43% making around minimum wage, which is or just above. Minor. I think it's fair to say that no state in the country is paying anybody $25 an hour as a minimum wage. So how realistic is it to say that a living wage at $25 an hour, that's something that we should strive for? How realistic is that?
That's a good point. On the other hand, you know, being at the bottom third of that is certainly not something to pat ourselves on the back for. And if you look at state of Virginia, Florida should take some pride that it's ahead of the state of Virginia. Virginia ranked at the very bottom of our index, absolute bottom, 51st. And if for a worker in Virginia at $7.25 an hour, say in Arlington, Northern Virginia, they're making $15,000 an hour. All they have to do is cross the state line, literally 2 miles. Work in Washington, D.C., and they'll be guaranteed a minimum income of at least $27,000 a year. That's nearly double, not quite, but it's nearly double. So the minimum wage does make a difference, and it's hard to imagine that the labor market for Northern Virginia and the labor market for Washington, D.C. is going to be that different. Yet workers who are at that bottom third, as you indicated, are you know, facing dramatically different compensation for their efforts.
Well, we're talking about a study from Oxfam America that puts Florida at 37th in the entire nation for overall worker rights and wages. And our guest is Minor Sinclair from Oxfam America. And this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Well, let's talk about some of the other things that Florida does or doesn't do. What happens to people, let's say, young people who are just starting a family? Let's talk about pregnant workers. Let's talk about family leave. What does Florida do or not do when it comes to pregnant workers and family leave?
Sure. First of all, it does not ensure accommodation for pregnant workers. And one of those is the right to pump in the workplace. And this is not a privilege. It's not something that one should have to ask for permission for. It should be a guaranteed right that's you know, goes across all workplaces. You know, I am glad to see is that Florida does have a basic equal pay law for both gender and race, And that's the only, you know, one of its only worker protections laws that it does have on the books. The rest of the policies that we looked at, Rob, you know, it's almost sort of kind of a clean slate there. It does not include, and that's paid sick leave, family leave, fair scheduling practices, this salary history, for example, in hiring to reduce gender and racial biases. Unlike 49 other states in the country, Florida does provide some sexual harassment protection.
Are there many states that mandate family leave or sick leave or accommodate pregnant workers, allow women to pump in the workplace? Are there many states that mandate that?
Oh yes, yeah. There are. It's not an uncommon practice. Uncommon practice at all. And for your listeners who would want to see the specifics of this, please take a look at our website, which is oxfamamerica.org. And we have both the overall study, but really interesting, the breakouts for each state. So people in Florida can look at, sort of see, how does Florida compare to other states? Rob, before we close, there's one thing that really surprised us as we did this research. And that and I think this goes back to where we started, is worker protection's good for anyone else other than the worker? And we did correlations. We associated stronger worker protections with other things in society, which I think everyone would believe is a good thing. For example, median household income, real GDP per capita. States with stronger worker protections also have higher income and higher GDP per capita. States with higher worker protections also have lower infant mortality rate. They have longer life expectancies. So this business of sort of kind of freedom, you know, I don't think we want to enjoy a kind of a freedom for infant mortality or freedom for low life expectancy. We want the policies to guide us in ways that are going to create good social norms. Interestingly, we also found is that these favorable worker policies are not associated with particularly with unemployment rates one way or the other. It's a net neutral, and it doesn't particularly associate with labor rate participation. We're a little surprised to find that, but again, that's a neutral. So favorable worker policies do contribute to social goods and that benefit families, individuals, and society, and don't seem to be taken away from you know, hiring practices, hiring opportunities, or people joining the workforce.
Minor, let me ask you one last question. I think everybody wants people to, if they're working 40 hours a week, I think across the political spectrum, we want those folks to be generally out of debt, be able to pay for their housing. If they choose to go to college, they could afford college. The existing generation, their kids will do better than them. I mean, we want people to be better off as a result of all the hard work we do. I wonder, you know, in terms of the strength of bringing people into the middle class, I wonder how the U.S. does compared to other countries. How are we doing making sure that if you work 40 hours a week, that there is some sort of social reward? You know, there's a social contract that says you're not going to fall through the cracks.
That's a great question, Rob. And it increasingly looks like is that you know, the American dream is broken. What we believe to be true is that work hard, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, is no longer happening. The United States ranks, I believe, 19th among Western economies in terms of social mobility. That is, people rising up. And I think in this day and time, people are stuck. They're at the lowest rung of the ladder, and scrambling. And they're not savings, and they're not covering their own needs. And for those that are, they're just a third of the working Americans are one paycheck away of going into poverty. And that's a car accident. That's a family member who gets sick. That's the loss of a job. That social mobility piece of that is just so critical. And I think one thing that our colleague from Cato and myself would agree on is that workers should earn enough so they don't depend on the government for assistance, for food stamps, for housing assistance, for supports for children. And I'm not talking about disabilities or pension or elder pensions. I'm talking about economically active population that can't earn enough and are depending on the government for services. Why aren't employers paying enough so the taxpayers don't have to come in and subsidize at those levels?
Well, that's a really good question. I wonder what those other 18 or 19 countries that are doing better than us when it comes to social mobility, what they're doing to get it right that we're not doing here in the U.S.
Well, you're certainly seeing that, an investment in education. Some countries are beginning experiments with guaranteed basic income. Other countries, the investment in social services, so that people have the skills and the opportunities to climb up the ladder. And then, frankly, there's a floor in expectations for corporations that are just not this low. The minimum wage in other Western economies is significantly higher than it is here in the United States. So, if you got a job, you're going to generally have enough to be able to pay for a modest apartment and pay for a minimum level of your cost of living. And that's just not true here in the United States. Yeah. And it's not true in Florida.
All right. Well,
our study reflects that.
Minor, people want to look at the Oxfam report on working conditions here in the U.S., how we treat our workers. Where can people find the report?
Great. It's called the Best States to Work Index. Again, Florida's ranked number 37th. You can get on our website, which is oxfamamerica.org. Google Best States to Work Oxfam, and it'll take you right there. We've gotten a lot of pickup for it from across the nation.
All right. Well, Minor Sinclair, thanks for coming on WMNF. Great to have you here.
Okay, my pleasure.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Good to talk to you. That's Minor Sinclair. He is the director of Oxfam's U.S. Regional Office and the Domestic Program on Decent Work. And prior to his role... currently, he co-founded Oxfam International's Cuba office and worked for many years on human rights and global issues, including overseas service with the Mennonite Central Committee. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We heard two views on what's going on here in Florida, the Cato Institute view and also Oxfam's view, which tries to reduce global poverty. Let's get your view on it. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. See, a lot of emails have come in the last 40 minutes, too. So I might read some of them going back to the first interview. There were about 10 emails about the first guest, and there's about four or five emails about the current guest. 813-239-9663 is our phone number, and this is WMNF in Tampa. I'm Rob Lori. Radioactivity is the program. Let's go to Will in Temple Terrace, who's been waiting a long time. Will, thanks for calling in. What would you like to comment about?
Hey, Rob. Yeah, so I'm a Florida resident for my entire life. I went to University of Florida for a degree in economics, and now I'm in the construction industry. So I think I've got, not to stand some sort of effort, but a pretty well-rounded view on this. And the first thing is with this first caller. So is he legitimately saying that, licenses for construction professionals are government regulations that need to be cut out?
He thinks that there should be largely deregulation of private contractors. I'm going to find the passage, but go ahead. What would you like to say?
Yeah, so, at the end of the day, the problem with the labor gap, and that is really just the demonization of trade schools and this big push that everybody had to go to college. Obviously we're trying to address a lot of that right now through the elections and through different priorities. But at the end of the day, his definition for freedom in Florida is 100% freedom for the rich. Like, it's just freedom for property rights, and the people that really get hit by it are obviously the most vulnerable people in the environment. And that's why you're seeing this huge wave of people that are showing up and voting, trying to get some vote or get some worker rights and some protections for the environment. It really is ridiculous. That's really all I want to say, because if not, I'm going to get a little upset. But, thanks for the call.
All right, Will, thank you so much. Thanks for calling in. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Nancy in St. Petersburg. Nancy, what would you like to comment about?
Hi. I grew up down here, and I started working down here when I was 15, and so I've grown with Florida, as you might say. And the thing is that it was considered traditional in the past to not pay people very much because they figured that, you know, you're in Florida, so you don't have to, you know, have high heating bills in the winter and have to have a lot of clothes. And besides that, you've got the beaches there. So it's like a compensation for low wages. I mean, this was told to me by people when I went to look for jobs. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
And the best time in Florida was in Brevard County during the time of the space shot, because we had all of those subcontractors who were unionized. There were unions all over the place because the educational level was so terrific in the schools over there. The schools were wonderful. As soon as everybody pulled out, the schools went to crap. And the whole place went country western. I'm sorry, but that's just what happened. They used to have jazz on the beach, and then all of a sudden it was country and western. And a lot of people who had bought waterfront homes over in Merritt Island and Cocoa Beach, all of a sudden they had to be selling shoes and not being able to pay their mortgages. And that was the end of that.
Yeah. There's stories now, Nancy, too, where teachers in some counties like Miami-Dade can no longer afford to live in Miami-Dade based on their salary. Some of the over the years we've reported on Disney workers who are essentially homeless because they can't get by on the wages that Disney pays. So
exactly.
It's
that's right. That's right. And yet we don't want unions. Are you kidding? You know, it's all of a piece. And you take the piece out that is called money, and the whole fabric falls apart.
All right, Nancy, thanks a lot. Yeah. Thanks. Sure. Good to hear from you. And let's go to James in Lakeland. James, what would you like to comment about? Hi, James.
Hey, Rob. I just wanted to call and thank you for giving some representation to literal vampires. You know, we're a misunderstood people, but it's really nice that you had somebody call in and give our point of view.
Which was the vampire?
That would be the Cato Institute.
Well, what was wrong with what he had to say about the situation here in Florida?
Well, I mean, if you could survive on drinking blood, nothing was wrong with what he said. But for the rest of us, the idea that money is speech is frankly just absurd. I don't even know how to argue against that because it's obviously not.
Yeah. All right, James, thanks a lot. Love the call. Good day from you. And let's go to Sean in Tampa. Sean, you're on WMNF on 88.5 FM. We've been talking about conditions here in Florida, whether or not we're the freest state or whether or not we treat workers well here in Florida. What do you think?
Thank you for taking my call. Let me just say, I moved here in 93 from the great state of Michigan. My parents moved me down when I was a teenager. But, you know, I'm indifferent. I mean, I've been very successful down here. I started out in a junkyard taking apart cars, and I worked my way up. I got into the auto parts field, got into management. I'm 40 years old, and I'm retired. I got into the National Guard. And I did what I can do, and I worked my butt off to get where I'm at today. You know, my 60 house was $60,000, or my first house was $60,000 in Plant City. It wasn't the nicest house, but I had a house at a young age. You know, I watched my credit, and I lived within my means.
Well, Sean, my guess is that you worked really hard throughout your life, and that you put
I worked very hard.
Yeah, you worked very hard. Do you think it's possible that if you were, let's say that you worked as a hotel maid, or if you worked as a bartender, or you worked, maybe as a carpenter, that even those people work really hard, but they have not been able to retire at the age of 40. And let's just say you're a teacher here in Florida, and you have to deal with third graders or seventh graders or 11th graders. You've worked really hard for 30 years. You still can't retire. Now you're 50 or 55. I mean, most people, you know, most people do work hard, but they can't retire at 40. So what do you think the difference is between you and these other folks that work hard?
Living within their means and where they live. You know, I did not want to live in a $60,000 home in a bad neighborhood in Plant City. But I had a choice to pay $500 a month for that house.
You think these teachers that are working hard, or these hotel maids that are working hard, or the bartenders that are working hard, that they're not living within their means, and that's why they're not able to retire at 40.
Well, I can't answer for them, but I do know that bartenders.
That was a question I asked.
I do know bartenders make very good money.
Yeah, but then I don't know a single bartender that retired at 40. Hey, Sean, we're out of time, but thank you so much. Thank you. All right, so you heard a variety of views on the topic. If you want to comment about anything you've heard here, you can call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment about this past hour on extension 115, and I'll play these comments back next Tuesday. We'll have a Labor Day special next week. Happy Labor Day. I'm Rob Lori. Stay tuned for the great Daniel Ruth. He'll set you straight in the next hour on Midpoint. This is 88.5 FM WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg.